Well, one of the finest UFO investigators and researchers out there, Timothy Good. He was last with me about 3 years ago, but he's back on Coast to Coast. We're going to be talking about some of his latest work, including Earth and Alien Enterprise. Timothy's next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Timothy Good, of course, has conducted worldwide research on the UFO phenomenon, including interviewing incredible key witnesses, discussing the subject with astronauts, military, intelligence specialists, pilots, politicians, you name it. He has lectured all over the place, university schools. He's been invited for discussions at the Pentagon, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Timothy, always a pleasure. How are you, Timothy?
I'm very well. Thank you very much, George.
You know, it's been almost 3 years, maybe a little bit more since you were last on. You've been very busy. Tell me about your latest work.
Well, Earth and Alien Enterprise, it took me 2.5 years of intensive writing, scrubbing out stuff and replacing it with something else. But finally, we got it through the loop, and it's published in New York by Pegasus Books. And
excellent.
There will be a British edition in due course, I'm glad to say, and hopefully it might go into some other translations.
This passion, Timothy, that you have for
yes.
investigating these UFOs, what drives you? What pushes you?
Just trying to find out what's going on, George. I certainly don't have all the answers. There's a great deal more that I don't know than I do know, believe me. And I've been studying this subject since 1955, would you believe, when it's a little story, but I had an American cousin, a second cousin of my mother, rather, who actually started the first magazine on computers in the 1940s, just after after World War II, and it was called Computers and Automation. And he was a whiz kid, very, very bright man. And he came over to England for a visit once, and he knew of my passion for aviation, and he said, Timothy, you like airplanes, you need to know about flying saucers. So he sent me a book, The Flying Saucers Are Real, by Major Donald Kehoe, and I haven't looked back since then.
That was a classic. The work of Frank Edwards in those days, Timothy, was also good.
Yes, absolutely.
Are we any closer to getting answers that you started looking for back in 1955?
Well, I think that thanks to certain leads in various countries, I've come up with some idea of what's going on, but the whole picture eludes me, I have to say, because it is complex. For example, there's a chapter in my book on Amicizia, which is I won't go into all the details. It's a very bizarre case. It went on for decades, involving literally hundreds of people. And dozens of people who were in direct contact, allegedly, with aliens who had a plan to give us their technology. And they have passed us their technology. This has been going on since the late 1950s, according to my information.
Wow.
As a result of it, not only have they given us the technology, but they've actually, in some cases, given us their craft. Now, you might think this would be the last thing in the world that they should give to Earth people. But the reason for it, I am told, is that there is a crisis regarding planet Earth, in that certain species have, for many decades, had their BDI on this planet.
Uh-huh.
And I'm talking about not just the bug-eyed variety, those who are involved in abductions, because that's very much the hybridization process is a part of what some of these aliens are up to. They're trying to produce a hybridized race, the better to take over planet Earth, supposedly, allegedly, George. I don't know, but I have been told that by more than one very reliably informed source. So the idea is that there is a serious threat to this planet, and we have their support in the event of a conflict situation. I don't know if it's true, but I have heard that from, as I say, informed sources.
Dr. David Jacobs, of course, also believes that there's a faction out there of ETs that aren't above board here. They've got a, I agree, yes.
He's done some great work, and I'm a great admirer of his work, and I agree with him on every aspect of the abduction scenario.
Timothy, as we get into all this that you've been researching and your new work, give me your overall perspective at this point, from 1958 to where we are today, all the work that you've done. What do you think is happening?
I think that we have been and are being visited by different groups of extraterrestrials, maybe some with different purposes. I think that many of them are actually based on this planet because Earth is unique. It's not unique in our galaxy. Certainly, that's for sure. But what they say is that it's unique in this particular part of the galaxy. Therefore, it is of use to more than just us human beings. And others have a vested interest in planet Earth, some for very, very positive reasons, others for negative reasons, as I've discussed, because there are those that are involved in the hybridization process who do most definitely do not have our best interests at heart. They have their own best interests at heart.
On one hand, you could say, you know, we're just a significant little planet among what could be billions of planets and maybe millions of Earth-like planets that are inhabited. But then again, when you look at this planet, Timothy, I think it's also pretty unique. I mean, it's teeming with life. It's got all kinds of human races. We're good people. We're violent people. We've got it all. This is a great place to study, isn't it?
Absolutely. No question about it, George.
So as we got into your latest work here, tell me the overall premise of this.
Goodness me. Not sure I can do that, George, but...
you can do anything, Tim. I've heard you before.
It just seems to me that some of these aliens have been here for maybe millennia. There are reports, as you know, going back as far as the Vedic hymns, the Hindu Vedic hymns, I've written about that. I mean, it talks about those Vedic hymns go back like from 1500 to 1100 BC before Christ, and they talk about spaceships. And I have had one of these sacred hymns translated from the Rig Veda, and it's quite clear. It talks about flying spaceships, and there are some details. So I think it's been going on for millennia.
Ancient astronauts.
Yes, and the Bible has all sorts of interesting things. In Genesis chapter 6 has always interested me. I don't know if I can remember it from memory, but it's like the gods came down. They saw the men on Earth, saw that they and the women were there was copulation between these giant aliens and men on Earth, and producing a different species on this planet. So there was some kind of hybridization. Way, way back, at least that's what it says in chapter 6 of Genesis.
And I remember reading that years ago, first as a youngster and then later on, Timothy, as an adult, fascinated by it. But what really struck me, and heck, I might have been about 14 years old, I thought that they were talking about some kind of extraterrestrial event.
And
present. It was, I don't know how a little 13, 14-year-old boy could think that, but I truly felt that, you know, my God, if you equate this with, you know, beings from outer space, this is what they're talking about.
Yeah. And as I recall from that chapter 6, it's that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and came in unto them and produced a hybridized race.
That's right. And in their image.
Yes.
In their image.
Absolutely. So we are a hybridized race, I think, and we are genetically related to other beings who were here before us.
In doing your research, did you scan the globe in terms of what might be happening in various regions of this planet, you know, in Europe, in different spots, in terms of ET activity?
Yes, it seems to be worldwide, but obviously some countries seem to attract more attention than others. South America, for example, has always been replete with UFO sightings, to the extent that in Chile, for example, the population really pays very little attention to it because it's so commonplace to see UFOs in Chile that they think nothing of it. That's what I've been told anyway by informed sources, like Antonio Huneas, who's a great researcher, and he's from Chile and a top researcher now in the United States and elsewhere.
What seems to be of the cases, recent cases you've looked at, one that you might want to be able to share with us, Timothy, one just boggles you?
Well, there have been some in my country, which quite fascinating. For example, only last year, there was a near miss with a huge craft reported by two passengers driving a car in the Teesdale area of England's northern Pennines. They were absolutely terrifying. They said it was saucer-shaped, dark on top, glowing underneath, and soundless, with steel-like tentacles hanging down. And they claimed that at the last moment it lifted up and narrowly missed their car before disappearing up into the sky. They were very alarmed by it, and other people, there was a guy, Roy Shaw, was walking his park. This is in 2010,
yeah,
in Exmouth, which is in southwest England, Exmouth, Devon. And it was about 9:30, 12, something between 9:30 and midnight. And he was with his dog, and suddenly a 100-foot craft landed in the park, and there was another witness. There were these two guys. There was this guy, Roy Shaw, walking with his dog, and the dog was terrified and barking at it, and it landed. It was there for a while, and as I say, another guy walking his dog saw this thing. The time actually was around midnight or towards midnight, and they were both terrified, and they ran away eventually, but not before Roy Shaw had memorized what he'd seen, and he made a sketch of it, which is reproduced in my book. And that was the last really significant event in the United Kingdom. But there's been a lot of events in China in recent years, a lot of stuff. I mean, for example, there's a Chinese rocket was being launched, the Shenzhou 9 was launched, and they reported two glowing unidentified objects which buzzed the spacecraft a few minutes after its launch. And these objects, whatever they were recorded by an infrared video camera monitoring the launch and spotted on a screen at Control Center in Beijing. And a lot of other events have happened in China and on the Indian border, apparently. A lot of reports have
Why do you think China?
Years.
Why do you think that region?
I don't know. I really don't know. But it's interesting. There's tremendous interest in China. I mean, apparently, according to Pravda, the Russian newspaper, half of the entire Chinese population believes in UFOs. And hundreds, possibly thousands of Chinese scientists are involved in official UFO research. And a former foreign minister, Sun Shi Li, who's chairman of the Beijing UFO Research Society, firmly believes that extraterrestrials are living among us. So that's an interesting perspective from China.
It sure is. I would guess that because China's technology is increasing at an incredibly rapid pace,
sure,
that maybe they've got their eyes on China just to see their development.
I wouldn't be at all surprised.
Timothy, when you said earlier that there are some people who believe that some knowledge is being shared with us, perhaps a craft has been given to us, who are they sharing it with? Who, and who's got it? Government has it?
Oh, sure. The United States Air Force has been flying some of these craft since the late 1950s, according to my information. Gordon Cooper, for example, who I knew, I never met him, but we corresponded. He had some experiences himself, and he told a friend of mine who was closer to Gordon than I was that this was back in 1978 when I think he'd addressed the United Nations or a branch of the United Nations that saying how important this subject was, but nobody took the slightest bit of interest in what he was saying. But he said, if it comes to it, I'll have to fly one of these craft and land it in front of the United Nations building in New York. That's how frustrated he was getting. So he actually told a friend of mine that he had flown these craft, which had been given to us or redeveloped by ourselves. I'm not sure which in his particular case. I know some craft have been actually given to us. Others they've just given us the wherewithal to produce these craft.
And what is so remarkable, too, is that, you know, these are very credible people. Astronauts, pilots, professional people, and you know, not to take anything away from the so-called average person who sees something.
Yes,
but I mean, these are professionals who are trained to look at aircraft and things in the sky.
Yeah, and in 1984, I'll get this in quickly, and you can ask me more questions later if you like. A friend of mine, Pamela Hanford, who was in MI6, was at a I think it must have been a semi-classified conference in Italy in 1984, and her room was next to Neil Armstrong, and she overheard a conversation in which Armstrong was talking to Professor Schwartz about what actually happened on the moon, and that they were very frightened because there were other alien spacecraft there when they arrived. Now, you might think this sounds absolutely absurd, but Armstrong did confirm that later on that day to Pamela, and he said they were very, very alarmed. It was just a quick visit, relatively quick visit, really, and they were alarmed by these craft. I don't know how long they stayed, but these alien vehicles, but I think there's at least one of them, one or two of them.
Picked up some rocks and off we went, that's for sure. So did they feel threatened at all, Timothy, when they were
they
on
did.
The moon?
They certainly did. That's what Neil Armstrong actually is recorded as having said to my friend.
I wonder what the ETs might have done to make them feel threatened, other than, I guess, if you would see them, let's say, on the other side of a crater, and that's always been a rumor I had heard. That's got to be a little jarring just to see that, I think.
Yes. I think the only person now, of course, who might tell us is Buzz Aldrin.
Right.
And I hope he does one day.
One day I would hope he would say something. He's been pretty closed mouth about it.
Yeah.
But you know, you never know. You never know. You talk a little bit about Eisenhower and extraterrestrials, and
oh my goodness,
break, but what happened there? I mean, did he really meet them?
Oh heavens, there's no question about it. There were two meetings arranged in California in 1954. And there were plenty of people present, named people. I've reproduced a document in the book, which is actually typewritten by one of the people who was present at one of the two meetings at Edwards Air Force Base in February of 1954. And it gives a great amount of detail. And then there was another one in 1955, which I've written extensively about because a lot of new information has been provided for me by Art Campbell, an American researcher, very high caliber researcher. He's given me a lot of information very generously to publish new information that he's uncovered about meetings in 1955 at Holloman Air Force Base when Air Force One was flown there. There was a cover story that he was just off on a holiday.
Hold on, Tim. We're going to hit the break, but I want to come right back. We'll talk about Eisenhower and the extraterrestrials. We're with Timothy Good, his latest work, Earth and Alien Enterprise, and we will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Our television program is called Beyond Belief, and you can watch it for 10 days free. Take advantage of this riveting interview coming up with Jerome Corsi regarding the JFK assassination. I mean, truly riveting. Take advantage of it. Simply go to this website, www.beyondbelief.com. You can sign up for it. It's 10 days free. Then you decide what you want to do. But you can also look at all the other videos and past programs as well. www.beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast with Timothy Good. His latest work, Earth and Alien Enterprise, a shocking truth behind the greatest cover-up in human history. Let's get into the Eisenhower meeting. I always thought for a moment, Timothy, that that might have been one of those tabloid newspaper type stories, but you've dug up some more information on this, haven't you?
Well, actually, it did make the tabloids. It was in the National Enquirer in 1979, a full page on it. And actually, I have to say that some of it's quite accurate, but the fact of the matter is that there were two meetings in February 1954 and I think April 1954, at what was then called Muroc Airfield and later called Edwards Air Force Base in California. And on a certain day, in one of these instances, a 100-foot diameter disc landed on the runway and was housed under guard in Hangar 27. And Eisenhower was taken to see it, apparently. And before this thing landed, a general had ordered all anti-aircraft batteries to open fire, which they did, but with no effect. And then the craft landed close to one of the base's large hangars. And there are named witnesses here. Who were present when all these extraordinary events happened. And one retired U.S. Air Force test pilot said that three saucer-shaped and two cigar-shaped craft landed at the base, presumably on the same day. The aliens looked human-like, the test pilot said, but not exactly. They had the same proportions as humans and were able to breathe our atmosphere. They did not say where they came from. In English, they explained to the bemused president that they would like to start an educational program for the people of Earth in order to make mankind more aware of their presence here. Unnerved, Eisenhower responded that he didn't think the world was ready for such a revelation, and the aliens apparently seemed to appreciate the fact, though they indicated that they would continue making further isolated contact with humans. They then demonstrated their ability to overcome gravity and to make their craft invisible. This disturbed the president greatly, said the test pilot, because now none of us could see them, although we knew they were there. And another event happened later that year in April of 1954. And there's a report. I've actually reproduced the original letter from a guy called Gerald Light. And he says, I made the journey. I've just returned from Muroc. This was the second event at Muroc in April 1954. The report is true, devastatingly true. I made the journey in company with Franklin Allen of the Hearst Papers and Edwin North of the Brookings Institute and Bishop McIntyre of Los Angeles. Confidential names for the present, please, he puts in brackets. When we were allowed to enter the restricted section, after about 6 hours in which we were checked on every possible item, event, incident, and aspect of our personal and public lives, I had the distinct feeling that the world had come to an end with fantastic realism, for I have never seen so many human beings in a state of complete collapse and confusion as they realized that their own world had indeed ended with such finality as to beggar description. During my 2 days' visit, I saw five separate and distinct types of aircraft being studied and handled by our Air Force officials. It has finally happened. It is now a matter of history. So that was the first event.
That's dramatic all by itself. What about the others?
It's well, the one in 1955 was when Eisenhower, at a press conference, stated that he was going for a few days' holiday, grouse shooting, I think it was, or quail shooting, I think, something like that. And this turned out to be a cover story. The plane did fly to a certain airfield in Georgia, but later on at night, suddenly the newspapers were told that Eisenhower had a case of the sniffles and he was going to retire to bed for a while as he didn't feel very well. In fact, he had been taken in great secrecy in Air Force One with just a few of his guards, I guess, to Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico, where they landed there. There had been a pre-arranged meeting with an alien craft, which later landed not far away from Eisenhower's Air Force One, a Lockheed Constellation. We do not know. People have reported that they saw Eisenhower actually going in the craft, but nobody knows exactly what the communications were all about. That happened, I believe, on two occasions. I have written at great length, thanks to information supplied for me by the great researcher Art Campbell, great amount of detail on that case. There were a lot of witnesses, named witnesses, some named, others who've chosen pseudonyms, who've come forward and said, yes, I saw that at close quarters. And some people were alarmed, other people were quite thrilled by it. So it's a long story, George.
It's a great story. Timothy, the great sighting stories, my gosh, to imagine that this has been going on, and
yes.
I mean, it's just mind-boggling, isn't it? Tell me, what was that story? This one goes way back. You looked at a study, what you call the environmental survey of a couple brothers in the North Dakota area?
Yes, yes. In fact, this is in the first chapter, Mike and Leo Dworshak. Leo Dworshak subsequently wrote a book, UFOs Are Real, Take My Word, which is available, and I recommend it. And he claims that with his young brother, Leo was 12, and his brother was a few years younger brother Mike, they encountered, it was a late afternoon in the summer of 1932, and they were walking not far from their farm, their family farm, in about a mile and a half east of Killdeer in North Dakota, when they saw this huge round craft. They didn't know what on earth it was, and it was sighted at first about half a mile away, and it appeared to be perfectly round, they said, with different colors of light that came from a band around the edge, the circumference of the craft. And they said there were flashing color lights which formed an outer shell like a band or belt that went completely around it at the widest point. And there's a great deal of information, tremendous amount of information provided. And what happened was that the craft landed and the boys tried to get near it, but they were prevented by an invisible shield which surrounded the area where the craft had landed. The boys could watch these guys. They seemed to be walking around picking up things. And eventually that turned, what they were picking up, it transpired, were actual grasshoppers. And they were actually testing the effect of environmental problems that even in those early days, apparently, we were having. I don't quite understand that, such a long way back, but this was 1932. And they continue to have these observations, and most of the time this completely invisible screen, you could see birds flying into it, but you couldn't, and they could feel it, but they could never get through it. But eventually they succeeded and they got closer to the aliens, and the aliens waved at them. There was some sort of communication, and eventually, to cut a long story short, after many visits by these boys, they were invited on board the craft. It was quite a large circular craft with magical equipment inside. They said, for example, there were armchairs which approached them and conformed to their shape when they sat on it, and all sorts of things like that. And they were given a lot of information. I don't think they said specifically where they had come from or anything. And I think many, many years later, when Leo had further encounters, because these encounters lasted throughout Leo's life, at any rate, or mostly throughout his life. His brother Mike died I think either the Korean War or the Second World War, I'm not quite sure which, but this went on for a very, very long time, and a great deal of information was given. And it seems that their main concern was the environment of the planet. And as Leo Dvorak says, you know, if their intent is to eliminate humanity, I have no doubt the easiest course would be to step back and allow us to destroy ourselves.
Yeah.
Yet they continue to return year after year, century after century, and work very hard while they are here. We never saw them in the winter months when insects and plant life are dormant. I think part of their work here was related to the study of how we were poisoning the environment in those times, and I think they were analyzing the grasshoppers, which eat a large amount of foliage, for chemical poisons in our environment. I know they are very concerned about our nuclear and chemical weapons and our warlike nature.
I believe
that. What a problem we must be for them, always threatening the health and safety of this beautiful planet, which is their responsibility to protect. The picture that comes to mind is a crowd of unruly children fighting and playing in a carefully tended garden with no regard for the problems they are causing for the gardener.
So true.
Nice one.
So true. Now, you've also written, this one fascinates me, about public landings, one in London. How could they get away with that? Tell me what happened there.
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because there were actually two events in July of 1955. There was a heat wave in England in a suburb of London called Bexley Heath. It's on the outskirts of London. And the temperature, I think, was about 100 degrees, which is pretty rare in the United Kingdom, but that's what it was at that time. And a friend of mine, Margaret Fry, was having to take one of her sons to the doctors, and the doctor actually came to meet her in his car and drove. They were driving on route to the surgery when suddenly the car started conking out in this major suburb, and it came to a stop, and a disc appeared above them, and it landed in front of them at a crossroads in this suburb. And of course, Margaret was with her, one of her sons, and the doctor. They all saw this thing. They weren't frightened, but they were slightly alarmed, and they didn't know. Nobody came out of the craft. It hovered just slightly above the ground. It was no more than about 25, 30 feet in diameter. And eventually, it just took off and shot away. It also transpired that there was another similar event with a slightly different craft of different design, and I've shown the difference between these two craft in pictures in my book, about three or four days prior to that, which Margaret was unaware of, and a craft landed in another part of Bexley Heath, and there were something like 100 witnesses. So in total for those two events, there were about 130 witnesses, and I have interviewed two of them, Margaret Fry, who is, she's still very much alive. She's a very fine researcher living in Wales. She's written several books on the subject, a very, very bright lady. She still stands by the story, and so did the other witness that I interviewed.
That's remarkable. I mean, that you could have 100 witnesses like that. If it would happen today, and, you know, with our social networking and the ability to get information out fast, what a story that would be, Timothy. Oh my gosh.
Well, one of the reasons it didn't come out was because it's not far from a military. There's a military base around there, and Ministry of Defence outfit, and officers from the Ministry of Defence descended hours later. In fact, some of them were there when these events happened. They were there very, very quickly. And they were telling witnesses not to report it, not to phone newspapers and so forth. There was, in fact, one report in one of the newspapers about one of the incidents, but people were told not to report it. And you could say, well, why didn't people take cameras? But not so many people had cameras back in 1955.
No.
And I think people were just astonished at what they were seeing. But it is a pity, of course, the photographs weren't taken. And that wasn't all that long after the Eisenhower event, you know, back in February of 1955. But this was July.
What a hotbed! Did you ever investigate the UFO flap over the Capitol building in the White House in 1952?
I did. I wrote about that at length, I think, in my first book, Above Top Secret. and in Need to Know, UFOs, the Military and Intelligence, which was my last book. And there's no question, these things actually were not just seen over the White House. They were seen at very low altitude around certain parts of Washington, D.C., apparently. Not landing on the ground, but very close to it, according to some witnesses at any rate. So there was an awful lot going on back in July of 1952.
That's just an amazing story. So many witnesses. Picture in the, I think it was the Washington Post. And you could clearly see objects hovering up there.
Mm-hmm.
Was there ever a major investigation afterward, do you know?
I'm trying to think of the general who was in charge of the investigations in the U.S. Air Force, but there were investigations, but I don't think too much came of it. I'm quite sure a lot of the findings would have been restricted. I mean, some of it's been declassified, but I'm quite sure there's a lot that remains classified.
Tell me a little bit more about the Vienna Woods story.
Well, this was interesting. Several events, one of which involved someone I knew, a Filipino guy who was a very fine pianist, and he was studying at the Vienna Academy at the time. Friend called Bobby, and he claims to have suddenly been, he was walking in the Vienna woods, and he seemed suddenly to be drawn to a certain area in the woods where there was mm-hmm. there was a kind of opening in the forest, and a craft landed in front of him, and several beings, humanoid beings, got out, and they communicated with him from a distance. He didn't get close to them. But they communicated with him and gave him certain information about his life and this and that. And he was quite alarmed by it, he told me. But I did believe him. He was a very honest person. And the other case is hilarious, really. It involved a guy who claimed to have seen, this was his second flying saucer event, if you like, his second sighting. He had been a saboteur in an anti-fascist group in Austria during the Second World War. But in 1955, he was on his motorcycle, and he said he claims to have seen a landed UFO in an area of the forest, the Vienna woods, and there was a ramp, and I mean, it's just unbelievable what he did. He actually cycled his motorbike up inside the craft. I mean, it beggars belief. It's just outstanding and very, very funny. And he drove up and he cycled up in his motorbike, put the engine off, and these bemused aliens asked him all sorts of questions. They were very humanoid, male and female. And they seemed rather amused by the whole situation, and they compared information about this and that. And eventually, he drove away, and he's drawn a picture of the event, which is quite useful, actually.
I would guess that there are some cases where these ETs are pretty baffled by us, don't you think, Timothy?
Yeah, I'm sure.
To figure out just who are these people. Well, we're at the top of the hour. Stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment. Talk more about the case studies, of course, with Timothy Good's new book, which is climbing up the charts at Amazon.com, Earth, an Alien Enterprise. You'll see it out there, and we'll be back. We'll take your calls as well on Coast to Coast AM.